You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website rickackerman.com. He's speaking to us from Florida. Welcome back to the show, Rick.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on, Jim. Always a pleasure.
Are the markets doing a pre-election adjustment?
Yeah, they've adjusted. They've adjusted the idea that there can only be one outcome, and that's a total Trump victory. And I'm a believer. I haven't tuned out the news, you know, even on the ostensibly conservative stations. Those guys are handicapping it like Pennsylvania is still a toss-up. It's not. I think this election's going to be an absolute blowout.
Well, somebody said Vegas is never wrong because the bookies don't like to lose money, and all the money's on Trump.
Yeah, I can't see it being anywhere else. And, of course, that's factoring in the enormous cheating that's going to take place this time because, that guy Mark Elias, who cheated Biden into office the last round, he's been hard at work for the last year kind of setting all the booby traps. But if we have a situation again where huge numbers of votes swing the election at 2 in the morning from precincts in Atlanta and Philadelphia and Detroit, we're going to be, I'm talking about a real civil war the next day.
The markets, what do you think is going to happen after Election Day?
Well, there's no question that the market understands the distinction between Trump, who at least represents, Trump's a businessman, and I think he's certainly doing a lot better this time picking the people that he surrounds himself with. That was probably the worst part of his inexperience on his first term, that he picked people who kind of steered him in the wrong direction. But he's got Bobby Kennedy, and he's got Tulsi Gabbard, and he's got a pretty good squad there, Elon Musk. So he's not a lack of good ideas, and I think that if he has a good sense to follow his advisors follow their advice, he'll do just fine. He stays on point. It's going to be hard to. I don't think he'll get taken down by all the noise that the opposition likes to create.
What's going to happen to gold?
Interesting you should ask. I've used a 2803 target for the December COMEX contract, and we got within less than $2 of that yesterday, like $1.50. And gold has come down a little bit since then. I don't know whether they've got an important top there, but I'm not. I've been bullish on gold, but I'm not someone who sees gold as an unlimited vista. And in fact, we may be at, if not a watershed top, we may be at a significant intermediate top right here. That said, if the December can lift above 2803 and close above that price for two consecutive days, I'd say we're on our way. I think the target up is 2940. So gold looks great. And it's still a question of whether the mining stocks themselves are ever going to catch fire. They're all going to kind of lag the price of physical because it takes a lot, really. It's one thing for all the different factors, geopolitical and sentiment and otherwise, to price physical gold. But when you price the exploration companies and the mining companies, it's a process. I mean, they got to move heaven and earth, practically, to get gold out of the ground and pulverize mountains, literally, just to get a few ounces at the end of the week. So the gold stocks are always kind of waiting. We really want to make sure that this bull market gold is going to run forever, and then you'll finally have your catch-up move in the gold, in the mining stocks.
Rick, are we still hung up on AI mania, and is it going to pan out? Because we just had a report that hospitals that were getting transcriptions of patient records and so on, AI was just making up stuff. That's kind of deadly.
AI stinks so bad it would take me an hour to get into to some of the reasons. It's awful. And it's somewhat ironic that they refer to the main thrust of AI development right now as proceeding from what they call a large language model. They incorporate pretty much everything that's been spoken or said or written, and they extrapolate a database that gives you knowledge, although no imagination or insight, into a great many subjects. So I still think it's valid to judge AI by what it does when you use your voice to text on your phone. And there it really operates with an IQ of about 40. I don't even have to describe the sorts of things that voice to text does or autocorrect, because we all put up with it. So that to me is AI, and AI is calling a clerk over when they have the automated checkouts, the scanners. You always need human help, and you can really tell, especially if you write for a living, when AI has done something. When you read something that's completely bland and, let's say, competent as far as the rudiments of English go, you know it's a machine that's doing it. Where we're getting fooled, really, is there are conversations. This is certainly true in the tech support world, or you'll call your bank and you'll think you're talking to a human being, but you're actually, more companies are deploying AI in that way. And virtually every company, with just a few exceptions, has moved away from talking to its customers. The last thing in the world any company wants to do these days is talk to its customers. It just wants to sort of pursue its business model blissfully, uncaring about customer satisfaction. They'll claim that they care about it, but anybody who does business with any company knows that they're, whatever they say about wanting to provide a high level of service, it's just a lot of crap. So, but it's true that you'll be talking on the phone now and you'll think you're talking to a human, but you're not. And that's going to become more and more, it's already at the level of insidious, but it's going to be at the level of ubiquitous at some point. We will never speak to human beings on phones when we're attempting to deal with the companies that try to sell us things.
Sure, you could demand, they say, who do you want to talk to? And you say, human being. That is not a selection.
Right, you never, that's true. One of the prompts is never, if you would like to talk to a human, press 2. You just don't get that anymore. And even some of the really good companies that tried to hang in there with real support, I'll name Logitech as one. That's a company that I do business with. And they put a human being on the phone. Brother, the company that makes the laser printers, they still have humans. But I can sense that Microsoft is kind of edging toward the AI exit there. They built a pretty good support network. And in fact, yesterday, it definitely was a machine I was talking to, but I've had an email issue that has defied solutions from their, I've got up to second or third level escalation with Microsoft. I was actually talking to the engineers, and even they couldn't figure out this little problem where my Outlook email simply wouldn't work on my laptop. It would not send receive. And I had a guy yesterday who, he took it outside of Windows and put it on the command line, and he solved the problem. I haven't seen this in years, really, where a tech support guy at Microsoft goes to the command line for a solution. But it was basically an instruction for Google to do something, and now my email works. So Microsoft has built a pretty competent support network because they changed their business model from you buy the update of Windows whenever to you subscribe and you get automatically updated. So they had to provide a higher level of service in conjunction with a subscription model for Outlook and the Office suite and the operating system. But I think they're in the process, if not dismantling it, of segueing entirely to AI technical support. And And I can tell you that's not going to end badly. It will end badly because the humans that would be the resources don't exist really to solve problems that involve the interface of different softwares. So whatever your software problem is, Microsoft wants to blame it on the third-party vendor, and the third-party vendor always wants to blame it on the operating system, on Microsoft. So we've been getting more deeply entrenched in that problem of things being too complex to solve anymore, we're at the state where no technical issue can be remedied, at least to the extent that it involves the interface between different third-party softwares.
Boeing is trying to raise over $24 billion to shore up its finances. How successful do you think they're going to be?
No one can say. I mean, it ultimately depends on their customer, their business. You know, I don't think that borrowing money per se will be a solution for Boeing. It's really just kind of a stopgap because they were on the ropes, and it's never a good sign when you're a major industry like airlines is in trouble. And of course, this is happening in Europe in a big way. When your manufacturing economy, which is so heavily focused in aeronautics, designing and building airplanes, makes a misstep, your whole economy is in trouble. So that's true for Germany right now because it is the manufacturing engine of Europe, and we're just having a little bit of manufacturing problem with their big problem is Volkswagen. And when Volkswagen stumbles, you better bet that all of Europe is about to stumble.
Germany was against Europe putting tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles because, of course, Germany's economy relies on the export of automobiles, a lot of them to China. China is now outselling the U.S. when it comes to cars.
Well, you talk about cutthroat. You know, the Japanese, that's the world's problem right now. Not only are they glutted with EVs, but other than in China, the tide is sort of turning. Americans aren't as enthused about EVs as they were. And so it's a question of how much excess supply the Chinese domestic market can suck up. But in the meantime, they're basically selling EVs for half the price of Tesla. And that's a big problem for not just Tesla and the U.S. economy, but for the whole world.
So I'm still here. I'm just checking it. Yes, I did check with Google. Of course, it never makes a mistake. China does buy more cars than America in recent years. A million cars a month or some ridiculous figure like that. So,
And you remember the good old days when it was the dream of American manufacturers to put a Buick Electra in every Chinese garage. But, of course, we didn't see it coming. China would become the premier producer of autos, and just because they have the domestic market to support quite a bit of growth, they were going to become more than competitive. So at this point, our Hail Mary would be a technology solution that gives an American a Tesla EV 1,000 miles of range or something like that. But just going head-to-head, there's not really that value in Tesla as there was. And all the other companies that 5, 6, 7 years ago decided to go take the plunge, they're in trouble. This is what Trump is talking about, like the American manufacturers shouldn't be incentivized toward the wrong incentive of producing too many EVs. So we have to kind of back out of that. That's one more thing that Trump will face in his first year in office.
We'll have more with Rick Ackerman right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Rick Ackerman. Rick, the crude market, you said Trump likes fossil-fueled powered vehicles. At some point, though, we're seeing governments right now are not subsidizing the exploration for oil. That's going to create shortages. Is the price of oil going to get out of the doldrums and start to skyrocket once those government cuts for exploration kick in?
Well, how many years have we been talking about peak oil and, you know, a shortage of oil? The only shortages we've actually seen were artificially created by the cartel or, let's say, geopolitical circumstances. So as a result, you look back over the last few years, oil has, crude has fluctuated within about a 20-25 point range, and it looks like a big consolidation. If there were going to be a big move in crude, I think it would be up rather than down. And when you say that, you have to, well, what would be the reason for that? And it certainly would not come out of, let's say, the traditional source, China being the biggest user at the margin, had pricing power over oil. So depending on how strong the Chinese economy was, that would factor directly into the price of crude. But, of course, the Chinese economy is in a wallow right now, and yet crude prices are still buoyant. And the reason I think that's so is they're buoyant because nobody really wants to be short crude, because at a geopolitical level, something could happen on any given day that pushes the price up $10 or $20 a barrel. So crude has a kind of built-in buoyancy that is pegged to the geopolitical risk in producing and distributing this stuff. And within that $25 range, it can be very volatile. We saw not too long ago where one day crude was screaming because there was this fear that Israel would attack Iran's energy, its fuel-producing facilities. And then the next day, when supposedly the Obama administration had extracted a pledge from Israel that they wouldn't go after the oil resources of Iran, the price it collapsed again. And so it's just one little headline story makes oil the biggest commodity market in the world. It goes nuts one day, and then the next day, it detumesses.
Cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin seems to be doing very well right now. Does it depend on how the stock market does, or is it its own master now?
Almost its own master. It's so cocky and confident that it can sort of go it alone. You'll see Bitcoin up on days when stocks are getting hit. Anybody who wants good Bitcoin forecasts should tune to Rick's Picks, because I hate the stuff. I think it's a fraud, but it's fundamentally worthless. But I've had no problem forecasting higher prices. I've been using a target of $81,000. I don't remember the exact figure, but once above that, I can tell you that the boys have $100,000 in mind. So I don't have any problem seeing Bitcoin go higher, even though it's a hoax. It's certainly not going to become a proxy for the dollar, and the same forces that are going to take the U.S. banking system down, that's inevitable, they're going to so completely undermine what misplaced confidence we have in digital money now. And by that I include the credit card system, which is still infinitely superior to Bitcoin. We use credit cards for transactions, but Bitcoin has never gotten down to a level where you could make it cost effective with credit card billing. So there's this pretense of Bitcoin is money, But the blunt fact is, it's just the speculative medium is all it is. And I keep using the example of that old joke about, oh, them's not eating sardines, them's trading sardines. And Bitcoin is definitely trading sardines. Nobody uses it as money, and it has not demonstrated any value at all in our payment system. So so Bitcoin is, it's just never going to get there. It's never going to be money, especially with the wild swings in valuations. So so them's my thoughts on Bitcoin, but I'm not going to put an absolute lid on it, because it could just continue to go crazy.
What's going on with uranium?
I think the uranium story is compelling. The more so because we're seeing that just in association with this AI, which, as I said, is a lot of BS, but it doesn't stop companies like Microsoft and Google from making plans. Well, for one, Microsoft thinks its power draw just to develop AI is going to be so significant that they might even need, they could use their own reactors. So I think that the smaller reactors are going to come into greater use. They're going to be built and used, and I think over time they're going to be our energy solution. But an irony is that part of the developing technologies for small reactors are that you get to you recycle the fuel more efficiently, so it doesn't necessarily mean boom times for uranium. But I still think, on balance, you're going to have increasing demand for uranium in the generation of power.
Now, talking about searching for power, Microsoft has struck a deal to restart the notorious Three Mile Island reactor to power AI.
Exactly. Yeah. And you look at it and you think, why not? We're not in the 1970s now, 1980s. The technology for monitoring reactors and shielding waste and everything else has improved a great deal since then. And it's not like we didn't learn from, well, Chernobyl, of course, but Three Mile Island. And we're in a very different environment. So Gates, he must know what he's doing, really.
Well, the difference between a U.S.-designed reactor and a Russian-designed one is the Russians don't believe in containment buildings.
Well, they did, you know, that they had a 6-part series, or maybe it was 8 parts, on Chernobyl, and it was really some of the best television I've ever watched, and it showed, it was remarkable. When the reactor first blew, the chunks of, all these big black chunks turned out to be the core. And they were the most radioactive pieces of what was expelled. And the locals came out, the people of in the surrounding area of Chernobyl came out to watch what they thought looked like a beautiful snowfall that night, but they were all irradiated to the point that pretty much all of them died. And so the Russians, I think, learned their lesson. I guess the reactors were built as sort of as part of the same quality control thing that gave us the LADA, the Trabant, the Eastern European Wonder Car. And of course the Russians were always known for the crudeness of their manufactured goods, but Chernobyl put a scare into them that at least has them thinking quality control whenever they build a reactor now.
Yeah, there's a reason why Russian fighter planes have the best ejection seats in the world, because the plane itself is crap.
Yeah, that was always the Russian story. They just didn't know how to build good things.
And well, it's because half of their workforce shows up drunk for work, if they show up at all. Alcoholism is their biggest bane. It's reduced their life expectancy by 6 years. And I think maybe the war in Ukraine's reduced it a little bit more.
And I think it reduces to that old joke about, and this dates back to the original five-year, you know, Stalin's first five-year plan, and that is they pretend they're paying us and we pretend we're working. And that became so deeply entrenched in the Russian mentality that that the only place where you get productivity is in military hardware.
It doesn't look like there's been any push at all during the U.S. presidential election campaign to federally legalize marijuana.
No, that's been coming since Lenny Bruce, you know, since the early 1960s. Lenny used to say that all of his lawyer friends would eventually become congressmen and they would legalize marijuana. But, of course, that was 60 years ago and it hasn't happened. So you're never going to do it now, because with the overturning of Roe v. Wade, it even more firmly fixed the idea that the state should be in charge of those things. And as long as the federal government enforces with a light hand, the states will be all right as far as they, to the extent they develop their marijuana business.
Rick, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
Yeah, my friend, I'll use just his initials, SB. He's been right about everything. He started out as a clerk on the Pacific Exchange when I was there as a market maker, and he worked his way up to the point where he owns some office buildings, and he was very smart about which ones he owned. He bought buildings where Starbucks was the anchor tenant, and he did really well in commercial real estate, and he exited at the exact top. You know, the bloodbath that's occurred in commercial over the last couple of years, he totally dodged it. He sold the top. He's been buying silver regularly, taking delivery on 1,000-ounce ingots of silver for years, and I watched him put his money where his mouth was and have the courage of convictions, because he bought silver from the mid-20s down to 20, 18, 16, 14, and I, even as he was doing it, and silver, there didn't seem to be a bottom in silver, I'm thinking he's always going to make money, he's always right, and sure enough, he got to sell all his silver that he bought down at 15 and below at prices well above 30. So he's been right at critical turning points so many times. To me, it's the same as if Warren Buffett were reported in the press selling all his Apple shares or whatever. This guy, he's not as rich as Buffett, but I have to I think he's almost as smart, and he has just blown out his entire hoard of bullion. He sold all his gold and silver, and he's going into treasuries. And when this guy does that, he's a deflationist like me. We share a deflationist point of view. And he brings in a couple points that I haven't mentioned. Number one, that Musk is already talking about how he could cut $2 trillion out of the budget, and Trump is going to be less likely to declare war everywhere in the world. But when you sort of play these things forward, they're all deflationary. I think we're getting that's what the bottom line is, really, when Musk talks about hacking some fat out of the budget and this and that. So I think we may be entering fiscally and in other ways, too, a deflationary environment. Interest rates, by my reckoning, are still headed higher, so that's going to impinge on borrowing. I would say what my friend is doing is very instructive. He's selling out of bullion right now, and he's moving more or less all in with treasuries, which if you follow the old adage, you got to buy them when nobody else wants them. Treasury paper is definitely in that, not going to call it the sweet spot. Everybody hates treasuries right now, and you have to ask yourself, well, shouldn't we be buying them then? And my buddy is. So that's the last word I've got for you today.
Rick, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you, Jim, for inviting me on. and giving me chance to connect with your audience.
My guest has been Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website rickackerman.com. If you have any questions for Rick or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Find us on X at House Street. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.